Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Once a month, Mayor Vi Lyles is on the program. This will mark our first conversation of 2022. At the end of last year, some key city personnel announced their exits. We'll talk about what that may mean going forward, about the mayor's priorities for this new year, the upcoming election, some new city council committee assignments, and more. But we will start with the latest crime and homicide statistics released by CMPD to council on Monday. Mayor Lyles, welcome back to the program. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to everyone, Mike.
So City Council, and therefore you, heard from CMPD on Monday night about the latest crime and homicide numbers. But before we talk about those numbers per se, a couple of questions about process and procedure. On Monday morning of this week, the city invited media to a virtual press conference with CMPD and Chief Johnny Jennings, but the details of what would be discussed were embargoed until 5:45 that afternoon. And that meant that the media agreed, although they knew what those crime statistics were going to be when they were announced to council, the media agreed not to report on them in any way until council heard those numbers. Embargoes are certainly not unusual in the world of cities and counties and any other kind of news report that we do. But who makes the decision about what to embargo? Is it the city or was it CMPD?
I think that in this case, the CMPD made that decision, but I can certainly understand why. Many of you know that I was a budget director at one point, and we used to embargo the budget, but we wanted the media to have access to the data so that when they had, once it was out of embargo or once presented to the council, that you would have the details and the information that you could think about what you wanted to present to the public in advance, but it would be timely. And so I think that CMPD, the chief, probably was the same as thinking, have a great story, be able to report to the media, be factual, but I also have to present to my board of directors first.
But there are annual, these are just crime statistics. These are not personnel records, not negotiations with third parties involving millions of dollars. Why did crime statistics rise to the level?
Crime statistics are very important in terms of how we assess the quality of life in many of our communities. And I think that what the media really gives, it kind of gives a level set to the media as well, so that you're not choosing one outlet over another. Everybody has the same baseline of information, so it's up to them to decide how they're going to communicate that. But I would say that those are the kinds of things that we know. There are stories like the tax rate and like the crime statistics that really address the heart of governance in our community. And that's why we try to do it in a way that's fair, allows for it to be reported really well, and yet allows the council members the ability to hear it first.
So let's talk about those numbers that came out on Monday. There is some good news to be found in them. Police say that overall crime in Charlotte was down 5% last year compared to 2020. Violent crime was down 7%. Did CMPD have any thoughts about as to why those numbers are lower?
Well, when we had the presentation by the chief, I think that he really talked about how they have adjusted their mission to be more specific around a number of these initiatives that we're taking, that we have invested more in terms of making our community safe. And yet, Mike, I think that the chief and all of the city council members would agree that while these numbers are down, that doesn't mean that they're necessarily good. That just means that we've counted and we're tracking and we're trying to resolve and provide methods that we can address the things that are most difficult. I'm on an email chain with several mayors across the country, and we were talking about this, and they asked the year-end statistics, and I sent them the report this week, and basically what I said is our numbers may be down, but that doesn't matter when you have people firing into a house. We lost a child from people just shooting into a home. And so numbers say one thing, but what we want to say is how do we address the violence in our city? And we're taking a number of initiatives around doing that. And we've got a lot more work to do. We don't want just numbers to be down. We want the reduction in escalation of violence in our city.
So as the numbers, even though the numbers have declined, the nature of what's happening in terms of violent crime is changing.
That's a great point.
Changing for the worse. CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings did credit a team of detectives that he created last year to focus on taking illegal guns off our streets.
Yes.
That seizure amounted to 3,000 guns being seized last year. That was up 33% from 2020, which I guess indicates that either there are more guns on the street to take or that the detectives that he put in charge of getting those guns off the street are doing a good job. And yet the number of schools or guns found in schools rose. What does that tell you?
Well, I think the chief was really candid with all of us. I read a statistic somewhere this past week that talked about, think about people in this country. For every person in this country, there are multiple guns that you could say that, I can't remember the exact number, but more than three guns per adult in this country. So we know that there are more guns. The gun ownership is greater than our population. And think about those that don't even have a gun. So what I think he's saying is that we have to pay attention to what the current state is, that people feel unsafe, so they buy a gun. We've talked about how people leave guns in cars and vehicles or are accessible for early theft. And we also have this issue around people buying guns and not securing them in their homes. So the chief is focused, the department is focused on trying to make sure that where there are guns that should not be in someone's control are taken in a way that is consistently enforced around guns and vehicles and stolen guns, other areas where we have guns that are used in crimes, not to see them used again. Those are the kinds of things that they're working on.
So the CMPD is aware of the problem, and obviously they seized 3,000 guns last year, which were illegal. What are the consequences when they seize a gun from somebody who should not have it in their possession, or it's not it wasn't registered to them, or perhaps they got it because they were able to steal it, which means that the gun was not properly secured? Sometimes these guns are being found in unlocked car glove compartments. What are the consequences of that? Because without consequences, won't this just continue to escalate?
Well, the ultimate consequence is that gun isn't used in the committal of a crime, it's actually saving someone's life in some cases. But at the same time, I'm not going to be a lawyer around this, and there are rules around how guns are confiscated and how they're used in the court system. And there's a whole train of steps that you have to take. And if you'll give us a moment, maybe we'll be able to share that with you from the police department and the attorney's offices that use this. But imagine, I think the goal is actually that the gun isn't used in committing the commission of a crime or the loss of a life.
But if there are no consequences for being in possession, above and beyond just having a gun, there's no consequences for being in possession of a stolen gun or an unregistered gun, if there are no consequences for the owner of a stolen gun not to be held accountable if that gun was not properly stored, then won't this continue to be a problem going forward?
You've seen it across the country that people are talking about the consequences. If you're familiar with the case where the young man had a gun and his parents were charged because they were aware of it, those are things that people are dealing with across the country. in Charlotte, I don't know that we've had the kind of effort, or if it's been required. I think the chief is taking effective action. We're seeing results, and we're looking at the ability to do this in the context of how we operate in the state and in our city.
So CMPD has said that in the year ahead, they need to focus on juvenile crime and making sure that teens as young as 12, 13, 14 years old cannot get their hands on guns. And Chief Jennings says, quote, far too many teens have guns, and that should be something that is unacceptable, not just from a law enforcement perspective, but from a societal perspective. That's what he said. Do they have a plan to address that?
Well, it's not just the CMPD plan, it's the community's plan, and the idea that how we've made investments in, the example is that what we're working with Atrium on, it has been proven that if you are in a situation where you've been shot, that the first thing that you think about is retaliation. And so when those young people are coming into the emergency room, Dr. Jacobs is leading the effort to talk to them, not about, well, we're going to just fix you up and then let you go on, but to the next step, which in their mind generally is, I'm going to get the person that did this to me. But we'll be providing support services to them, counseling. Why did this happen? What do you need in terms of your lifestyle that we can change to make sure that this doesn't happen? So that I think that we're trying to prevent it. Retaliation, we're trying to manage in terms of de-escalation training. The council invested in a huge amount of programming and training for our officers to get to the place that we don't get to the gun result, but we talk about the conflict and how to change that conflict from being something that escalates. And the chief talked about that a good bit and was really complimentary to the officers that have participated in this and are working on it in some of our most difficult neighborhoods and other areas that we've identified as vulnerable.
The Charlotte Mecklenburg schools, excuse me. Are under the gun, not to be flippant about this, in terms of getting control of these incidences where guns are found, and one gun in fact was fired at on a CMS campus toward the end of last year. And Crime Stoppers has increased the reward for reporting a firearm on a campus that leads to the arrest and a gun seizure. They've increased the reward from $250 to $500, which is a lot of money to a young person in school to see something, who sees something, to then tell about that something that they saw. But so far, they have not paid out a single amount of money for anybody making a report. Again, what does that tell you?
I think that says that the program was just initiated at the end of 2021, and we haven't had a chance to get that out into what I call the streets. I mean, you know, letting people be aware that they have this. Nobody's going to step forward if we don't tell them about it. And the program started at the end of the year, and how the chief and the department communicates this among the school system and using our school resource officers, I'm sure that they have a plan. And I think that will make a difference.
So crime is down. Violent crime is down. The number of guns on the streets being found by police appears to be rising. And the number of homicides reported was down 18% last year from 2020. There were 118 homicides in 2020 as opposed to 98 in 2021. Did police in 20 seconds or less offer any thoughts as to why the drop in numbers?
The de-escalation programs that are taking place in the city, the open conversation that we're having in our city about how we have to be safer and how we have to make sure that people are not harmed by violent crime.
We'll talk some more with the mayor about that, about other things that happened at Monday's council meeting and some other moves on council, etc., when we come back at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Mayor Vi Lyles is with us for our first conversation of 2022, and we've been talking so far about what the council heard on Monday night from CMPD about crime. The level of crime has dropped over the last year. The level of violent crime has dropped over the last year. Some other figures: total arrests are down 4%. Aggravated assaults are down 3%. Robberies declined 22%. Property crime decreased 4%. But rapes are up 19%. Vehicle thefts rose 5%. Vehicle break-ins are up 4%. Does anybody understand why? And are these crimes concentrated in particular parts of the city?
You've asked the same question that the council members asked of the chief. And in terms of the issues around the break-ins and the vehicle thefts, while they're up, I think that when you look at the trend, that these increases are within a norm, perhaps. I think on the sexual assaults, the chief is going to provide us a report, because he says those numbers can often be under in single digits or in the low teens. None of that's acceptable. But at the same time, when you have that kind of small sample of to work with, the percentages can go up when this happens with one or two cases. What the chief did say to us is that often the most difficult part of sexual assault is that the victim knows the perpetrator, this is not a good morning, I guess, for me to with the P sounds, but perpetrators. Mm-hmm. And so that's a tough and a horrible crime, and one that's difficult to sometimes predict.
Although you did say your reaction on Monday night to hearing these new figures, you said, quote, "I think that Charlotte represents the very best. I don't know another city that has had a reduction in crime this year." Have you had a chance to check that? Is that actually true, that we are the shining star in the constellation of cities where crime is down? And if so, do you think enough people know that?
I think that, Mike, I have a kind of a list of peer cities, benchmark cities that I work with on a regular basis. We try to support each other in any effort that's ongoing, all the way from when George Floyd's murder occurred, what are we doing, how do we make any adjustments, all the way to affordable housing, all of those things we talk about. So when I make that reference, it's common, I think, to the council members that I'm talking about those folks that I communicate with on a regular basis.
Okay. We'll talk about your priorities for 2022 in a minute, but Chief Jennings says his top priority is addressing violent crime. But don't these statistics show, the ones that we just went through, that violent crime has already experienced a decline this year, aside from rape? So is he saying that we simply need to build upon the work that has already been done to reduce crime, that's resulted in a reduction of crime? What is he saying here?
I think that the chief would say, absolutely, that's what we're doing, that we do need to continue to focus on the efforts that we have that are not just in the department. We need to make sure the department has the resources and the communication ability across the ecosystem in our neighborhoods to be successful. And that's what the Safe Charlotte is all about. That's our plan.
Before we moved on, I asked you a question about the consequences for being found with a gun that's not registered, or a gun that you stole, or if you're a gun owner who has not properly secured their gun and it's used in the commission of a crime. And your crackerjack assistant has gotten back to us on that. Jeremy says, punishment for carrying illegal firearms is a Class G felony, and a 12 to 26 month prison sentence could be the result of that. City Council is beginning to work in earnest on the Unified Development Ordinances. If you're not familiar with that, you soon will be as we go through this year, because this Unified Development Ordinance, the UDO for short, codifies the aspirations set out in the Charlotte 2040 Comprehensive Plan that was so controversial last year. One of the things that council heard, we heard, you heard on Monday, was a plan to extend the community comment window for 2 months on this UDO. What kinds of feedback has this plan received so far, either from citizens or from members of council?
Wow, if you look at the efforts and the energy that's been put in place to communicate two documents, the 2040 mapping process as well as the UDO, that we have actually gone out and talked to over 400 or almost 500 people, surveyed them, had them reply to things that we had comments, but you individually can go online and comment this about anything in the plan that you want, and the staff will, there will be responses to those comments. What we're trying to do is make sure that there's as much engagement from both an individual level as well as from an interest group level. So staff is continuing to engage in virtual conversations and responses to the comments for both the mapping and the UDO. But we wanted to expand the time frame for that because we really understand, and I've said this on your program before, the mapping is about what you would ordinarily consider the zoning. It's what we want people to build on and what they would be allowed to build as a part of our planning. The UDO is the how. So it's the what and then the how. And the how can be just as complex as the what. And so we're managing both of these efforts at the same time, but there is a sequence that the mapping has to be correct. And then we go into the actual how it gets done. And so you can go to charlotteudo.org and comment and provide information that you want to see. But more importantly, if you go to the mapping for the 2040 policy map, you can actually challenge, well, this property isn't single family, it is, you know, commercial or industrial, and help us make these corrections, because we're over 300 square miles of property in this city. And the staff is working with maps that were outdated 40 years ago from when you look at how things were designated. And we're working, this is a major initiative to update, become current, and to provide us a plan for the future. And the communication is deep and long and still open.
And council has recognized how complex this all is, and that's why they want to extend this citizen review period, because the document itself is 608 pages of highly technical, sometimes legalistic language, and it takes ordinary citizens who don't deal with this every day a lot of time to actually figure out what's being said. And I'm wondering, if people are taking advantage of what you've provided them in terms of this website where they can go look at the maps and they can make comments on the maps, are people doing this? Are ordinary people taking the time to do this? Or are the people who are taking the time to do this actually professionals, developers and the like?
There's two ways to look at this. On the mapping, generally, that's where people look up their address and their house and they want to comment to make sure it's accurate. But our city is fortunate to have major neighborhood associations. And those neighborhood associations are reviewing it for their neighborhood, their boundaries of what they consider their neighborhood. And they're coming in and providing us information about what needs to be done. The UDO, which is how it gets done. You know, I live in a house, but I don't build a house. And so the technical details about what materials, how it has to be built, all of that reply is in the UDO, and it is more complicated. And there are several chapters in it. So you don't expect the person that's calling and saying, I'd like to see my neighborhood be an N1 and an N2 and then an activity center, to be able to say, well, you know, an activity center has to have this number of square feet, no drive-through windows, all of those kinds of things. So hopefully we are listening hard enough to the folks that have to have the detail, that we're hearing and able to write the UDO in a way that those experts and the expertise needed is there, but also to be sure that when we do the new mapping, that people understand what the neighborhood standards are, the activity centers, the industrial things, those correlate more effectively to the existing zoning that most people think about.
So that newcomers to Charlotte understand why we're doing this, and even those who have lived here a long time who may not have been paying a lot of attention. For about 30 or 40 years, as you just mentioned, Charlotte was operating under outdated maps. Development regulations were written into 8 different ordinances: zoning, yes, subdivision, tree, streets and sidewalks, floodplain, soil erosion and sedimentation control, post-construction stormwater and driveway and access ordinances. And this UDO, the Unified Development Ordinance, will put all of those rules, regulations, restrictions, whatever you want to call them, in one place and allegedly make it more user-friendly. I've read through some of this. I'm not sure that that's even a possible task, to make it user-friendly. It wasn't to me. So explain to me how it's more user-friendly. Just because it's all in one place?
Technology has changed all of that. You know, we have these books here that are, you know, like ordinances books, and people have to look them up. But just the ability to say all of the things that we've done in terms of technology, word searches, subject matter searches, that's going to help. And I'm glad that you use the 8 chapters, because most people say, you know, oh, it's over 600 pages, but it's 600 pages with 8 chapters that people need to be able to reference and understand. And I think that it's going to be successful. I believe we as a community understand that we need to have the development community work with us. We need to have people that are coming into the city to understand what our rules are. And that's what's happening with the UDO. What's more important is the decision of what we want to be rest in the hands of more of most of our residents. And that's where we're focused.
In the 3 months since this document was released to the public on October the 7th, 485 people have participated in virtual conversations with the planning department. And there have been over 500 comments published on the UDO website. Put that number into perspective. Is that higher than, lower than, about the same as other areas in which you are encouraging people to read, review, and comment?
I'm going to take an educated guess that this is more than okay. What I usually see in terms of engagement. When we talk about engagement in the city, oftentimes we'll go out and we'll say, think about Safe Charlotte. We brought in 30 people from the community that we thought were community representatives and asked for their feedback and to react to that. 30 people as opposed to over 500. And the development community is certainly greater than 30 people. And they are all working together with us to make sure that we are working in a consensus mode, not necessarily that everybody agrees on it, but we try to work that people can live with it in the development in the UDO. And it's clear and it has an intent and purpose that's clear why we're asking this of our development community, as well as why we're working with our neighborhoods and other folks that are very keenly interested in this work.
The UDO is coming into focus and under discussion at precisely the time where the person mainly responsible for it, city planner Taiwo Jioba, is leaving to go and become the city manager of Greensboro. What impact will his departure have on this process?
Well, I sent Mayor Vaughn in Greensboro a text after Ty was selected as their city manager. And I said, this is great for Greensboro. It's great for Ty's professional growth and personal growth. But at the same time, the reason that Mayor Vaughn and the Greensboro City Council hired Ty was because of the work he did in Charlotte, because they're about to embark on a comprehensive plan. Mm-hmm. And no matter how much we have bumped heads and had disagreements on things, this work that he has done across the country is recognized as something that's truly remarkable for government and necessary for what people are going to expect as we continue to grow. And Greensboro is growing. They're beginning to attract industry and manufacturing again, and their population is growing. And I feel like they're getting a step out there. And they're getting it with a good person to lead it.
Again, a little historical perspective. When Taiwo Jayoba took this job, and it wasn't that long ago for Charlotte City Planner, the city had been without a full-time city planner for about a decade, if I'm not mistaken. Will he be replaced in short order, or will we have a series of or one interim planning director as we had before for so long, which led in part to the fact that we neglected the need to update our plans for the city going forward for about a decade?
Well, I think that Ty has been a leader in this, but he certainly isn't the only person that has been working in the in-depth and ways of understanding it. We've got a great team. Allison Craig, Alicia, who has been out in neighborhoods. I don't know if she ever gets to go home before 9 o'clock at night out there. And so our planning folks have really understood the vision. And I think we're in an implementation phase right now. I think that we will be fine in terms of what we've laid out as a vision. We're now working to make it possible. And we have to acknowledge that when people come to Charlotte to work, they're often sought out nationally. And I have to wish them the best. I don't want us to have a city that nobody wants the people that we employ. So it's a bittersweet kind of look at it. So now we're going to go and try to find someone that will be our new assistant city manager. We've got a really strong planning director in Allison. So we'll see how it goes. Fortunately, the city manager has that responsibility to advertise and seek out the very best, and working with the city council to explain why that person is the very best to come in. So we'll have a recruitment process, and we will be looking at people. Maybe we won't be going to Greensboro to get anybody, but we may be looking, we will look at and have a national search.
And just before the end of last year, the city's Housing and Neighborhood Services Director, Pam Weidman, a frequent guest on her on this program, announced her retirement. She's been working on one of your pet projects, and that is affordable housing, for quite some time. Can you share in 30 seconds some of her contributions toward that effort and whether or not her successor has been identified?
We doubled our investment in affordable housing, and we have over 4,000 units underway under her leadership. 4,000 units of affordable housing, with 20% of that for being at the people that make the least amount of money in our city. Pam is a rock star. She's such a quality person. We're going to miss her, but she's going to work hard for someone else, I'm sure.
So when we come back, we'll take a look at some other changes on council, some shifts in committee assignments, and also at your priorities for 2022 and more with Mayor Vi Lyles. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our first conversation of 2022 with Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles underway. You announced some changes on City Council this past week, and you've nominated Councilman Malcolm Graham to head the Council's Economic Development Committee. He will replace sometime rival Tariq Bukhari. You're also changing the name of the committee. It was years ago the Economic Development Committee. Then it became the Workforce and Business Development Committee. And now you're changing it back to the Economic Development Committee. Why the changes?
Well, basically, you know, sometimes you have to be very flexible and realize what you think is a good idea isn't necessarily what really works for everybody. So we have an economic development department and a function inside the city. And I wanted to try to focus this economic development on workforce development specifically, because we were so engaged in projects. But hey, when things don't work and everybody calls it economic development, you just ought to call it what people use as a common term for it. And that's why I said, let's just go back to what we're doing. But that does not change my focus. The whole idea of economic development, we can bring in a lot of new. But for me, what my focus has been and will continue to be is providing jobs for the people that live in this city so that they can work and live here. So when I think about the work that this committee is doing, the studies that they have under how do we make sure that we have the talent so that people can have good paying jobs, But that's just a part of it. We have to continue to recruit and retain businesses. But I believe that the foundation for recruiting and retention is around good training for people that live here that have made it possible for us to have the city that we have. Mm-hmm. And we have to make sure that there are opportunities for those that are currently here as we continue to grow.
Why the change in leadership at the committee level?
Well, you know, I look at this and I think about Malcolm's leadership, and part of this is our work on the corridors. We have a real emphasis on corridor development, and Bates Fort Road is in District 2. Malcolm has done this development work. He's worked for several corporations, both as a staff member and as a consultant, that really does focus on how do we integrate and have a really large ecosystem to create along our corridors that. So, and then the vice chair is Ed Driggs, and Ed, his talent and background in economic analysis, and how I believe the leadership in that committee is going to be very strong.
So Malcolm Graham told the Charlotte Business Journal's Eric Spanberg that under Tariq Bakari, his predecessor as chair of that committee, that the committee didn't really have a focus, and he wants to create that focus by saying it used to be the committee to be on council. Do you agree with Malcolm's assessment on Tariq's version of
I think that the work that the committee has been doing around workforce and creating a plan, they've been working on it for over a year, this plan that we're going to have. I think that's going to have great benefits. And Mr. Bakari helped do that. He's good at the idea of how do we create jobs. But it's bigger than just the financial and technology industry. I look at jobs paying $50,000, $60,000 a year. We want to be very careful that we don't target just one area. This is the idea of having a community that's diverse in opportunity is just as important as having the diversity of population in terms of race and gender, all of that.
Because Tariq Bakari said that in making this change at the top of that committee, you acted out of, quote, vindictiveness, because he challenged you on how federal recovery dollars were being allocated to the mayor's racial equity initiative. That's something that came to light just before the holidays. We talked about it the last time you were here. What's your response to that charge?
My response to this is that I know who I am. I know how I work. And I believe that when I make this kind of decision, it's a thoughtful one. And it's something that I've talked with a number of people about. And I think it's the right decision. So when I look at this, I just live the way that I govern and manage this role. It's not always an easy role, and sometimes the decisions are harder than other times.
Bakari told the Business Journal that you told him that you couldn't, quote, have someone in a leadership position who refused to show proper respect. Is that true? And if so, to what are you referring?
Oh, yeah, that is definitely true. Okay. I would never say that that's not true. But the conversation was much broader than that as well. But I also want you to note that Councilmember Bakari is still a committee chair and one of our most influential as we're trying to work towards more collaboration with our governmental entities inside of our county, as well as at the legislative level. He's effective. He's got contacts and influence. And so we recognize that. And, you know, when you look at the committee assignments overall, you think about this. We've got Victoria Watlington is going to chair affordable housing. She is also someone that is experiencing growth in terms of affordability on the west side. That's not all of her district. Her district is a full range, but I'm trying to put people where their interests are and where they can see results that are meaningful to them.
Just yesterday, another city council member, it was reported, Braxton Winston, has become the subject of a criminal summons ordering him to appear in court over a complaint for assault on a female filed by his ex-wife after her own arrest for reported assault, I believe, on him. Has this ever happened before to someone on council?
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, you know, council members are people, too. And life experiences happen. And I would expect that it's not an isolated incident. I think it's a truly unfortunate one. But at the same time, people sometimes people don't understand the pressures and the stresses of this job. Not to say that they're connected, but it certainly is the pressure of visibility. I mean, you do, if I do anything, last week I got a call about I didn't pay my taxes. And I was like, what are you talking about? You know, one, I have a mortgage, and so I have to pay my taxes because the bank pays them actually. But, you know, people will call you and just say things and you're like, your adrenaline goes up. I was like rushing to say, did I not pay the taxes? Did something happen? I spent 45 minutes just kind of like in a rush to say, wait a minute, this is something someone just raises an issue and I have to address it. And that visibility, every step you take on this path is just very wide open.
And we should be quick to point out that this summons that that Braxton Winston received is not an arrest order or a warrant. But if it goes any further, what would counsel's action be, or what would the city's action be?
Now, this I do know, that the form of government that we have and the rules that we have is that the people elect the council members, and there are very few ways to remove a council member, one of which we know a felony, because that happened with one of our former colleagues. Mm-hmm. And I believe that we just follow the rules and the guidelines, and those requirements are there and they fit.
So let's talk about.
If they fit, then they have action. If they don't, then that person continues in their role.
Let's talk about your priorities for the coming year, 2022. Correct me if I'm wrong. I believe at the top of your list is mobility.
Absolutely.
What does that mean?
What that means is that I want to say thanks to Harvey Gann, who led a group to say that early on, before we even started talking about the mapping and the vision for the city, we knew that we were going to grow 200,000 people or more in the next 10 years. The size of Greensboro will be coming to Charlotte. And we know that that means people have to be able to move around. And mobility is not just driving, it's walking, it's biking, it's buses and trains. And so he worked together to give us this kind of idea that if you put all five modes of transportation on the table, what would we have to do? And we've continued to refine this over the last year. And the issues that we have are going to continue to grow if we don't have the money to do this. We're going to work hard to get the federal dollars here, but federal dollars require us to actually help match that money. And we believe still that the transformation of this city for being able to keep people to go to work and go to home and have the quality of life in between those two anchors is that we have to fund mobility choices. And that's with a sales tax. I believe that, and that's my top priority.
Okay, this plan is officially called the Transformational Mobility Network Plan.
Yes.
And I think it was late last month that Councilmember Tariq Bakari and Republican strategist Larry Shaheen spent a day in Raleigh meeting with House Speaker Tim Moore on this plan. They're all three Republicans, and maybe that conversation was helpful, but do you think it was helpful? And do you believe that you or other council members should have been in on that meeting?
I think that any conversation that we can have with the state leadership or our delegation or the governor's office is always going to be educational, informative, and helps us explain what we're trying to do in Charlotte. So that's important.
So the sales tax that you just referenced to help pay for this plan, this particularly the light rail portion, it would be a 1 cent sales tax addition, which requires A, permission from the legislature to put it on the ballot, and it requires it being on the ballot. I believe I'm right in that. And it was going to be tentatively on the ballot last November until that election was postponed, delayed, and canceled because of problems with the census. Will it be on the ballot this year?
You know, I think we'll have it on the ballot when we've reached agreements with every part of the county, our mayor, our other towns, as well as the city, to be able to be successful. We need to do the groundwork and the explanations and then get out and talk to the community and the voters to make sure that they understand that we'll do it when we think we can get it, be successful at it.
Well, you know, Charlotte's not the only government that's short on cash. Even the North Carolina Department of Transportation is $12 billion short of what they need to build roads in the next decade. And there was an editorial in Tuesday's Charlotte Observer about a frustrated GOP wondering why citizens aren't celebrating the tax cuts they've been given, which don't amount to much to the average citizen. And the average citizen also looks around and sees prices rising and sees sales taxes rising as a result of rising prices. And they think that their taxes have gone up because in some instances they are. The tax breaks actually went in many cases to big business and not to individuals. And that article, that op-ed, the editorial rather, in The Observer quotes Democratic State Senator Dan Blue as saying most people would prefer that their tax dollars be well spent than reflexively cut to serve a low tax philosophy. In a state that is growing as rapidly as ours, that needs money to improve infrastructure to handle the influx of people, have we provided too many tax cuts to corporations instead of spending money on things that would benefit voters?
When you're the mayor of a city like Charlotte or Raleigh or Greensboro, Asheville, you certainly, I think, we share a perspective that our infrastructure needs an infusion of cash, and it needs it quickly because of the growth. But I also know that the state has to look at rural communities, but at the same time, we ought to be investing in our rural communities with broadband and giving them the economic opportunity. They need that. We need better roads to our rural communities. We need broadband for our rural communities. So infrastructure is key to our growth. And I think that to have money in the bank and have people not have jobs is not a philosophy that I can see as being successful for our state.
Speaking of political philosophies, President Biden was in Georgia yesterday talking about the importance that the Congress passed the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act and the Freedom to Vote Act, and he expressed his willingness to back a rules change in the Senate that would have a carve-out for the filibuster, eliminating it so that the Congress could debate and then vote on these two bills. In light of what you see Republican lawmakers doing here and nationwide to diminish access to the voting booth for people least likely to vote for them, how important do you think passing these bills is, and how detrimental to the Democratic Party will it be if they don't vote for this?
Well, there is an article in the New York Times this week, and it talked about this issue on Sunday. It was in the Sunday Times, and the future can be very dark in the respect for having two political parties that can't come to a consensus that the right to vote is one of the most important ones in our democracy. And I believe that we have to figure out this. Fortunately, Mecklenburg County has a great board of elections, and this idea of trust, I believe, is still strong in our own community. But trust can be so easily broken if people continue to think that you can, that the system is rigged or not appropriate, not done correctly. So it's frightening. It's a little bit scary, especially for those of us who fought so hard for the right to do this.
As President Biden said yesterday, the defeated ex-president is saying that the previous election was rigged. It was not. So are Republican office holders and those who are running for office supporting Donald Trump and his big lie, if they continue to insist that the 2020 election was stolen, which it was not, are they fit for public office?
I heard your NPR interview with the former president this morning earlier, and it was disheartening.
That was Steve Inskeep's interview.
And it was truly disheartening. Every day I think about how do we keep Charlotte in a way that expresses our values, and how do we do this in our country? I don't have an answer yet, but it is certainly disturbing.
Okay. Mayor Vi Lyles, thanks for the first conversation of the year. That, by my count, there should be 11 more to go.
We'll see, Mike. We'll see.
Thank you for the
hour. The other mayors need to come on as well.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.